Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every fortnight, I speak to scientists and economists, NGO leaders, grassroots activists and environmentalists, business executives and investors, a mix of conventional and unconventional voices, exploring diverse perspectives and practical solutions, and challenging conventional wisdom and dogma. The Irish anti-war movement is a membership-based grassroots organisation which campaigns for the non-militarist and peaceful resolution of conflict. It partners with like-minded groups internationally, like Stop the War Coalition in the UK and Code Pink in the US, and with friendly local groups, the Peace and Neutrality Alliance and the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Recently, the Irish anti-war movement has been active in organising protests focused on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and NATO's role leading up to it, and Israel's ongoing barbarous military assaults on the densely populated Gaza Strip. The Irish anti-war movement is also engaged in an ongoing campaign to defend Ireland's neutrality from Irish government plans to sign Ireland up to NATO. Please support the Irish anti-war movement by going to irishantiwar.org, where you can subscribe, join, and make a donation. I'm very pleased today to welcome Dr. Zander Dunlap back to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Zander is a research fellow at the Institute of Global Sustainability, Boston University. Much of his work is focused on the political ecology of low-carbon technologies, extractive development, and police-military transformations in Mexico, Germany, Peru, France, Spain, and Portugal. Well, thank you very much, Zander, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast once again.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really pleased to be back here, Fergal. I'm really happy to be here and talk about this book.
Your new book's called The System is Killing Us, Land Grabbing, the Green Economy and Ecological Conflict. So maybe just before we start, if you can tell us a little bit about what you do, what's on your mind, you know? I say this often, but it's probably never been so true, but we're facing, I don't particularly like the term the omni-crisis or whatever they say, but, you know, no shortage of traumatic and challenging situations, not just on the environmental and sustainability front. Right now, amongst the various challenging situations, what worries you the most?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll start with kind of the first part of what you're saying. The book, The System is Killing Us, you know, I originally had a different title for it called Permanent Ecological Conflict. But this one kind of grabs the headlines a bit more. It's actually a 10 years in review of all the work I've done the last 10 years in different kind of land struggles. And ultimately, the book kind of comes about as being deeply dissatisfied with what's going on in academia or kind of the popular left publishing in terms of the conversations people are having. And in terms of maybe kind of answering your more immediate question in terms of what kind of concerns me the most in terms of this kind of the face of kind of socio-ecological and climate catastrophe, or I guess like the UN likes to say the polycrisis, is just really the way that environmental policy has more or less become a new gateway and method of kind of continuing capitalism, but ultimately perpetuating kind of ecocidal behavior and processes, if not ecocide itself. So we're kind of in a situation right now where the solutions are very much the problems. So a lot of what people were kind of talking about in the 1970s and 80s as solutions and even the 90s are now these problems. And, you know, maybe kind of a fun kind of cultural reference, you know, the old punk band Oi Polloi, they have a good song, you know, harness the wind, harness the waves. We don't need no nuclear waste. And the thing is now the waves and the wind and the sun are being harnessed. And it's coming with, it's wedded to the existing system. It's wedded to capitalism. It's wedded to modern and industrial development. So you're seeing this kind of rapacious kind of rolling out of these projects: wind, solar energy infrastructure, more high tension power lines, more transformers, which require an insane amount of mining. Not to mention the idea of electric vehicles, which is one of the most frightening things in the world, to actually having this passed off as environmental policy, having this passed off as being green. And of course, this is done with kind of ideas of kind of carbon accounting. But I guess to kind of just to sum it up is that I'm deeply concerned that the problems, the solutions have now become the problems, you know, low carbon infrastructures, kind of things that kind of constituted pathways for sustainability are have now been kind of transformed and are being rolled out on such a scale to kind of power the existing system that ultimately mining has become synonymous with environmentalism, which is insane. And it's something I guess we could say Orwell foretold long ago.
Yeah, the low carbon solutions, I mean, there's few that would disagree that that's essential. Carbon transition, electrification, central to many calculations, many ways of thinking and looking at dealing with the climate crisis, at least. You have some problems with the way that's interpreted or the whole idea or how it operates on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is really important. And I guess this is kind of a big kind of basis of the book is that, you know, so obviously, and let's be clear, you know, I'm an advocate of wind energy development. I'm an advocate of solar energy development. I'm an advocate of reducing, reusing and recycling as much as possible. However, you know, the way, you know, we live in a capitalist society and, you know, and even a lot of the kind of the state socialist societies were also very much organized along authoritarian and kind of capitalist lines, at least in terms of mass production and industrialization and kind of spreading that model and that relationship with the planet, the rivers and the trees. So to really get to the point, you know, right now with the European Green Deal, with these different kind of packages of the Green Deal in the US, the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, we're watching ultimately this energy intensive consumerist society that's designed to constantly consume, to constantly make a profit, to constantly produce more products, to constantly manufacture and process different kind of plastic trinkets or high technologies. It's continuing unabated and without any reflection. And unfortunately, the only reflection is, yes, let's build more low carbon infrastructures. Let's build more wind, solar. Let's build more high tension power lines and energy transformers to connect and to collect this. And let's apply market mechanisms and make it so we're that there's people actually profiting and trading off of, yeah, ultimately off of the human right of actually having availability to at least to electricity, to water, to housing. But that's a good part of what the book is about, is actually looking at the different kind of high tension power line corridors and the spread of these projects and actually the deteriorate, like the detrimental kind of impacts they're having on the environment. And the way that they are spreading and reliant on increasing insane amounts of mining. Exactly. But yeah, maybe I'm going on a bit long, but I mean, a big problem, as you kind of pointed out in the question, is I'm completely dissatisfied. And that's kind of what the first chapter talks about with actually the science and the method of accounting that goes into even measuring and looking at this crisis. And when I say this crisis, I mean a socio-ecological crisis, a biodiversity crisis. Just maybe a crisis of relationship and actually how people live, think and breathe and how they exist in their environments. But the way that everything has been quantified and reduced to carbon as a way to kind of look at the world and to measure it is completely inaccurate in terms of actually looking at the depth of the damage that's being done and kind of the details. And even by this own kind of calculations, which I have a lot to say about in the book, it's still all signs are pointing in a negative direction, but it's actually really serious what's being ignored when we're just actually looking at carbon, when we're just looking at quote biodiversity in terms of actually how ecosystems are set up and how they arrange with each other. And the same goes for how I think a lot of academics, also a lot of people, how they even think about industrial supply chains and how they're not actually looking at the extractive chemical and manufacturing processes that are even behind, you know, wind turbines, solar panels, energy infrastructures, yeah, which is, yeah, a theme we talked about a year or two ago.
Yeah. I'd be interested in getting what your thoughts are about how it has changed. For many, the potential of the sustainability agenda, as it were, was never very promising due to the structure of corporations, what their goals are, their fiduciary responsibility, the way that's interpreted in courts and so forth. So to some extent, for some, that won't be a surprise. They'd say, well, what do you expect?
I think one of the concerns, one of the points that the book is an intervention against is the way that there's been this kind of ecological authoritarianism that is this kind of emerged. It's always been around, but it's actually become a bit more pronounced, and I think it's getting a lot more attention in some European countries. But there's people actually trying to repackage and talk about kind of ecological Leninism. And this book is a direct intervention against this kind of authoritarian solution and kind of high modernist ideology that's kind of being employed to try to address and kind of this, yeah, ultimately this idea that the state and some type of an authoritarian communist or socialist state will be able to regulate and enforce and to stop ecological crisis.
Can I just jump in there for a second? Because for many people, their main concern would be that the state is not doing enough. They would say, you know, the state is sitting there, that it's not getting involved, it's allowing the market to do it, it's not intervening with regulations, it's not taking the initiative with, you know, powerful ideas, transformational ideas. That's quite fringy.
Yeah, it is. And it is, but it's gotten a little bit of, it's surprisingly, this kind of next generation of kind of climate youth and marches and academics have kind of taken it up a bit uncritically. And I'm a bit surprised how political ecologists haven't been more critical of this.
I'd like to discuss that in detail maybe in a moment. If governments and state-driven solutions aren't, state approaches aren't key and necessary, and corporations, well, we'll get on to those, but have, you know, have their own agenda to many extent, degrees, you know, where is the change coming from in your view?
The book itself is an advocate that the change must come from us, must come from below. It must come from maybe even turning backs on these institutions. But I don't take this kind of above or below kind of dichotomy. My position is that wherever you are, there needs to be the development of a real, everyone from where they stand needs to do everything they can to actually create more liberated spaces, to actually begin connecting with their environments and to stopping this, and to growing their food, to reclaiming urban environments, to depaving streets, growing their food, taking back their power in every sense of the term, in terms of literally and metaphorically. So while I think that really, given the track record of what has gone on, you know, I mean, we can kind of look at this, and this maybe goes back to your kind of an earlier part of one of your questions. You know, in the 1972, we had the Limits to Growth Conference, you know, and around that same time and before that, we had some of the strongest environmental legislation coming about, you know, the Clean Air Act. Literally some of the strongest environmental legislation in the world was coming out in the late 60s, early 70s. Limits to Growth, kind of looking at this, that was actually really trying to be like, hey, you know, we actually have to question growth. We have to question industrial modernity. But, you know, along come the 80s, with sustainable development, which said, oh no, growth is a friend of the environment and we can do both. And ultimately how that has just enabled and prolonged and prevented a self-reflection on these things, moving more towards this kind of high technology approach. And again, we have the exact same approach as sustainable development today, but now under the new kind of more technical terminology of decoupling and the various types of decoupling that are going to say, oh, how to decouple the economy from ecological degradation. But yeah, I mean, it's a same and old problem. And the book is really trying to, is really saying, you know, we have to do it. Like, we have to do it from where we are. We really have to critically assess and change our lifestyles. And I mean, as someone who works in the academic sector, this is a very toxic sector that needs to definitely change. And not only, it needs to be the ones that are setting the example, especially at universities, to actually be growing food on the side of walls, be, you know, creating forest gardens, becoming energy self-sufficient, and really trying to demonstrate real acts of renewability and sustainability. Because at this point, when words like sustainability, renewability, clean, I mean, these are all just public relations jargon words that are just trying to greenwash really destructive industrial activities. But again, just to kind of reiterate, because I don't think I was clear on it enough to your main question, the book is saying that, of course, first and foremost, we have to do this. But people have different skill sets. They're in different places. They have different possibilities and privileges and advantages. And it's really to say, wherever you are, make that space, collaborate with the movements, do everything you can. Say, for example, if you are a politician and you are deep in these things, but you really care about the environment, hey, a great thing that can be done is to eliminate terrorism enhancement acts and laws that are being used against environmental defenders. create more funds to research degrowth and to kind of roll these things out. And I mean a real degrowth, not the stuff that's really starting to manifest. But, and same, if you're a mayor, start doing more radical initiative, creating that space to actually try to create real, genuine socio-ecological sustainability and renewability. And this goes to say that the grassroots movements, the anarchists and the different people and factions out there, they certainly have a role to play to kind of press on that and to take that. But I the way I imagine it is that it's really up to everyone to do everything they can in an informal way to kind of create a better, healthier kind of planet. And it's not going to just be some top-down thing. It has to come from below, but it has to come from everywhere.
I guess there's some people who'd say, well, that's a fantastic vision. And of course, there are tremendous social ailments in society, and there have been for forever in many ways. And of course, we want to, you know, improve things. But we have a burning bridge. The planet's on fire. We have a certain amount of time before certain kinds of tipping points are likely to emerge. They may already have emerged, you know, that we need to be really focused. You know, it's really about the clean energy transition. What you've got to do is you've got to say, listen, you know, it's the carbon emissions, you know, stupid. That's what we've got to focus on. Therefore, we've got to focus on that first and foremost. And yeah, we'll try and include these other, you know, ideas as well. And we're all for it. Yes, of course we are. But we've got to be focused. What do you say when you hear those kind of arguments?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, but it's the same story. It's actually, I kind of relate this to this kind of big man, kind of masculine thing. Like, oh, don't focus on the details. Don't focus on your local relationships. Don't focus on these things. Look at the big problem up here. And I mean, this relates to my critique of climate change. And I think Peter Gelderloos is really good, where he brought up the term climate reductionism. And then there's been some cats up in Sweden who did a good thing called carbon tunnel vision. And I think this idea of climate change, and I've been saying this for a very long time now, this idea of climate change, it's very interesting how we went from kind of ardent, radical, ecological struggle, you know, especially in the late 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And then somewhere around 2010, 2012, it started shifting into this idea of climate justice and this really moving it away from our immediate sphere of influence, our immediate areas of action, and saying, and being like, oh, it's so big, it's climate, it's up there. And this has, and obviously there's a benefit to this, right? We get to say, oh, this is a planetary crisis, this is huge, this is big, this is concerning, we have to do something about this. And so that's the benefit of it. However, to that point, it seems like the more people know or talk about the environment or specifically climate, the worse it gets. And so I think there's a very weird correlation there that's surprising. But my concern is this, is that we're talking about the climate. And then all of a sudden, when we talk on this large scale, it's governments, it's corporations, it's international panels, and maybe NGOs to agree who are allowed to sit there that are the agents of change who will make this happen. And that's a disabling effect. You know, it's ultimately saying, you know, keep calm, carry on. You know, the queen and the government, they'll handle this thing. And it doesn't work like that. And that's how it's been going this whole time. We can't keep kind of reiterating this same kind of process. And as we spoke years ago, you know, when we talk about carbon, when we talk about these measures, when we talk about this push towards this framework of climate change, you know, it's the World Resource Institute that was the one in 2001 that even kind of is setting the terms of actually calculating carbon in terms of its destructiveness and also its commensuration with methane and other gases.
Yeah, no, I think this is really important, and it plays to something. I mean, Mike Hume, who I've spoken to a few times, is something he talks about as well. A few key variables, you know, carbon emissions, the measurement per million, the 1.5 degrees. You end up in a very technocratic, model-driven version of the world we're living in. You can imagine a time where they re-released the statistic, the analysis they did on the measurement of one or two of these key variables around which everything seems to revolve. But actually, they discovered that the way they were averaging them was using the wrong matrix or wrong variable, or they were measuring heat from a biased, shall we say, perspective in terms of, you know, trying to get a fair representation of land and sea and, you know, whatever, that suddenly everything we thought was the case isn't quite the case. And we're potentially looking at the screen or in New York City or in London, the big cities, of how these measures are changing, and check your measures today. And this kind of, it's a very abstract technocratic vision.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a huge problem. And I mean, it's from my perspective, it's designed to fail. Like this whole approach, the way we think, work, academicize, you know, measure these things, it's putting the cart first. And it's not, I mean, really, climate change in the end is a series of hundreds and thousands of local environmental interventions in terms of cars, factories, different ways people are relating to their environment, you know. And, you know, let's not forget the biggest contributors to climate change at this point are the militaries of this world, is the war, is the ultimately the genocide that's going on in Palestine, among other places. You know, it is the war, it's the military industrial complex, not to mention the internet infrastructures, the data centers, the amount of energy they need, even our clicks on Google and things like this. Like, these are the big perpetrators of these things. But again, going back to kind of where we're starting about talking about, you know, this kind of measuring of climate change, it's designed to fail. It's really designed to actually not address these issues. I mean, our whole society, the way it works, like look at my own job. The amount of resources and energy I use to give you more precise calculations about how messed up and how destructive and how unevenly developed and the impacts they're having on different communities that wind, solar, and other energy infrastructure is having is insane.
That's interesting, because very often when I talk to people on this podcast, I ask them, you know, I suppose some of the things that, you know, inspire them, not just worry them. Of course, one of the things that inspires many, many people is the fortitude, the attitude, the bravery, the outspoken quality of young people. For sure. And another one is the radical fall in the cost of solar energy and the commitment to wind energy, but more the solar. And this is used as a kind of use case for decarbonization and so forth. Now, this hasn't been your experience. And can you just talk about what your view is on these renewable energy sources going forward?
Yeah, I mean, we're almost getting into our next podcast for the project that I'm working on that's been looking at solar panel supply chains that I'm not going to say so much about right now, but it is actually deeply and fundamentally concerning what is going on in the deserts and how entire desert ecosystems, which are crucial for carbon sequestration. A fun thing that I feel embarrassed that I learned recently is actually how deeply important desert ecosystems are in terms of, you might look barren, unoccupied wasteland, but there is extremely biologically diverse, not to mention, as some have called it, there's an upside down forest in the desert, meaning that literally when you look under the soils, you have such extensive root systems as big as any forest underneath the desert that are doing all sorts of things. And I guess more for this quote carbon and kind of climate discourse and debate, they are huge carbon sinks. And right now we're watching the California, Arizona, you know, Western United States, among other places, we're watching these desert ecosystems being eradicated and turned in from very diverse and deeply beautiful habitats. If you can actually look close and see them, we're watching diverse and thriving habitats being turned into solar monocultures. And so, I prefer not to get into that so much more. That'll be the topic of my next book.
Can you talk about the dangers of extractivism and what it actually is and how you see the lay of the land at the moment without necessarily going into solar supply chains?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can talk about another way. I've worked on other things like this. I mean, so there's a lot of debates in the extractivism literature right now, but I've always found it's been a bit limited in actually looking at the spiraling kind of supply webs and chains of kind of extractive activities. I mean, you need extractivism and some form of violent extraction to even be able to have a more extreme version of extractivism, to kind of sum up that literature. But like we spoke about...
Extractivism. Sorry, what is extractivism?
I mean, so extractivismo is a concept that comes from Latin America that is, you know, there's classical definition that's looking at how, which is ultimately a way to kind of talk about neo-colonies and how environments are being completely eradicated and destroyed to serve as kind of raw material hubs for the developed North. And so along with the classical definitions, it means that, you know, not only is there a huge environmental degradation through some type of traditionally oil and mineral mining, or even kind of, you know, kind of agricultural extractivism, but that a lot of the raw materials and what's being mined, at least 50% or more of that is being shipped out of the country. So like the global South, in quotes, traditionally, and which we still see today, especially with the green energy, so-called green energy transition and all these climate change mitigation schemes, that you're seeing this kind of this treatment as resource colonies to export to the global North to manufacture these things. Not to mention these industries are majority controlled by private foreign sectors or even large kind of oligopoly kind of national sectors. And this also relates to kind of deleterious and destructive kind of labor conditions and things like that. And I might be forgetting another feature, but then there's been debates to actually show like, hey, you know, to even have agro-extractivism, people are using now RFID chips and different kind of apps, pesticide supply chains, genetically modified kind of seeds, like all of these things have in and of themselves and the machines that are being used, all these have extensive extractive supply webs. So you see this kind of, in my mind, this kind of total extractivism or this multiple and cumulative extractivism that's taking place. But to make it more relevant for this conversation here, you know, we're watching the same pattern go down. We're watching the same pattern be renewed and, quote, greened in terms of. So now we're watching the same dynamics take place, but now it's to produce low carbon infrastructures, tons of wind and solar, tons of, you know, energy infrastructure, smart cities, new different kind of digital technologies that are monitoring our consumption or creating more efficiencies, quote unquote, or with electric vehicles that are reducing emissions within cities in the global North. But what's interesting, and this goes back to the accounting conversation, is that so we can take Oslo or any European country, and they're saying, yes, we're having a reduction of emissions, we're phasing out diesel, we're enforcing through electric vehicles, through different kind of tax incentives and pressures on the population. And they account that because they're only accounting what type of extraction and extractivism is happening within their border. They're not actually including this by going outside the border. So what's interesting is you're witnessing this demand, this intense and frightening demand of minerals, cobalt, nickel, lithium, copper, iron ore, you know, terillium, you know, the rare earth elements, which I have difficulty pronouncing still after 10 years. But you have this insane demand for these things, which is leading to these crazy chemical processes, destructive mining, horrible labor conditions in the global South. And, you know, I'm thinking China, I'm thinking India, I'm thinking Brazil, among, you know, not to mention the lithium triangle in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Argentina. But so you're having this demand being pushed so everyone can have electric vehicles and be green. And so, you know, the UN and, you know, all these different European cities can walk around and boast how they're the greenest, healthiest, safest place in the world. But they're creating net global extractivism and destruction. We're on a closed planet. So yes, while an electric vehicle will reduce carbon emissions in a city, it very well might create net greater destruction. I mean, I would very much bet the greater levels of destruction that are spreading through the planet, not to mention how it makes these countries look like bad, quote, dirty countries who are not greening themselves with these same industries and technologies by producing these technologies for the global North. So,
but these technologies, are they very different? These kind of things you're talking about, that's not new. You know, we've been living with, you know, dirty industry, dirty mining for decades. So is this different? Is this materially different? Is this quantitatively different?
I mean, in a sense, no, it's not different at all. And that's the point. It's extractivism. However, there's a psychological component and it's psychologically different. And this is the frightening aspect of it. You know, psychologically, it's green. It's becoming environmentally friendly. It's green extractivism, you know, which is the negative term for it. And it's the sense that people think things are getting better. People think things are becoming more environmentally friendly. People think that the governments are making actions that are doing these things. But as you said so nicely, we are having the exact same, excuse me, they're not the exact same, but we are having similar, extremely similar, if not, some could argue, worse, especially with rare earth element mining, among others, that worse conditions of industrial production and degradation in terms of producing this new set of, quote, green or decarbonized products. And so what makes this different, besides the products, which I would say are only superficially different, is that now you have mining companies claiming that they're moving towards net zero by using ideas of, quote, renewable diesel, which is ultimately just fossil fuels, or excuse me, biofuels, which again is a whole nother issue, not to mention using biofuels in these enormous haul trucks for open pit mines, for example. But it's also subcontracting for renewable energy companies and how they have their own solar and wind kind of projects to kind of power the mines themselves, which has been going on for some time, which again ignores the supply chains for those wind technologies or solar technologies or the infrastructure that supports it itself. Not to mention a big aspect of to kind of green this mining is ultimately rolling out digital sensors to control different air ventilations for underground mines, keep track of dump trucks. This also relates to the move towards automation, you know, which is ultimately a threat to labor as well. So it's just a continuation of the exact same process of extractivism. And they try to call it green. It's not green. And it all rests on this idea of the science of this. And really, I would say it's not science. It's arithmetic. It's accounting. It's a type of econometrics, maybe. But it's really what's justifying this and why you have different companies right now, especially the big mining companies running around saying that they're going to be net zero in 2023 and different things like this. And they are making efforts and they are investing money into these things. But it's ultimately, yeah, it's just promoting more mining. It's promoting their own industries. And people think that somehow having Teslas and whatever type of electric vehicle and whatever new kind of technology or paying the weird whatever fees to kind of green their transportation somehow is making things less worse. When if you look at the numbers, even if I'm highly critical of climate change as a framework and highly critical of the science in terms of not revealing how bad the ecological destruction is, even by the accounting that I disagree with, it's still a deeply concerning process and not changing. So,
and getting greenwashed along the way, as you say, in a very profound way.
Yeah, I mean, that's the new thing, is it's just a form of greenwashing that is really, it's a psychological intervention on people to actually not care, to think things are going to be okay, while the exact same or similar processes are continuing under a green veneer.
At the heart of your appeal, I suppose, is for everyone, for all of us, to somehow be involved, to become educated, to become literate, to understand what's happening, and then to start to take action and to become involved in some way or other. And I suppose, you know, in that the way the whole climate and environmental problems are, the way they're framed often in terms of the Anthropocene, it's become very bandied around term, talk about, you know, what's happening today. And many people like it, somehow at the very least points to the level of scale of the outcomes of human action in terms of, you know, pollution and so forth. They're just the enormity of it. But at the same time, it blurs, you know, ideas of causation, what's really driving this, and can often lead to a kind of pointing the finger at the species of man. We would prefer, I think, and are interested in other ways of framing this. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about how framing in the first place, how important that is, and then maybe just a little bit about what your preferred way of understanding what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, for the first part of what you're saying is, you know, it's act local, think global. You know, people need to act. And I would actually wager with you that, you know, the way that we're living, our regimes of work, of course, we're surrounded by enchanting technologies, junk food, television, and things like this. But if one was to judge by rates of alcoholism, drug abuse, and suicide, you know, modern industrial society, you know, is not all it's been kind of cracked up to be and what people have kind of hoped for and how modernity has been sold for the last 200 years. And yeah, it's time for a real serious readjustment, I think, in everyone's lives, you know. And I'd look at my own first in terms of, you know, what academics are doing and how this works. And really the university sector and academics need to be setting the standard for these changes.
Is there not a danger here that, again, we're veering into, you know, I mean, the Frankfurt School was around and, you know, those ideas wouldn't be new to them. Is what you're saying therefore just tied to a particular political stance and a particular ideology that maybe not everybody sees the world that way, and that when you start to get into important questions like, you know, work-life balance and conditions in the workplace and techno-feudalism or technological saturation, and, you know, it's endless time on Instagram and YouTube, and where do you draw the line?
I mean, certainly people don't see it this way or want to think about it like that. But what, and sure, it can be related to my own political reflections and how I kind of see and relate to the world and what's going on around me. But that's what I'd say is, I'd say that our bodies and the planet are giving us very clear indications about what's working and what isn't. And I would think that we should try to respond to that the best we can. And I say the best we can because obviously people are, many different people are in very different circumstances dealing with very different and often fucked up things in terms of where they're working, their labor conditions, what neighborhoods they're in, the type of police or paramilitary presence in the area, the different levels of racism that are kind of going on, or discrimination of all the rainbow of discrimination that's kind of put on people. So, but I think it's on us. And that's kind of the point of the book. It's on us to actually find each other and begin organizing and doing these things the best we can. And if someone's like, and that's the thing, it really depends on your political analysis. If your end game is like, I love my computer games more than anything, then it's kind of like, all right, then clearly what I'm saying isn't going to be a priority for you, you know, and same with whatever kind of high technology that one might be addicted to. And I say addicted because it is a very serious issue, technophilia and techno addiction. And it's been a big issue for at least 20 years within the corporate sector and kind of human resources and how they're managing. Ultimately, how people are becoming more addicted to their work and also to their electronics and the negative effects they're having on the relationships in their lives. And then I would extend that to actually how we ignore our environments and how we're not listening to them, how we're not working with them. And here we are talking about socio-ecological and climate crisis.
Now, at the same time, there have been some initiatives, shall we say, recently, over decades, really, the degrowth movement. I interviewed Jason Hickel. The whole question of economic growth as an ideology or economic growth, it's been a recurring theme to some degree, but it's been around for a while and it's growing, and there's more research, there's more interest, there's more engagement. And so that's one area where economists or generally people feel interested and engaged. It's a different paradigm, a different way of looking at things. And I suppose the Green New Deal initiative that promises the model of, you know, the New Deal, and which again give rise to great optimism. You talk about this in the book, both of these movements, as it were. Can you tell us what your view is on these?
Yeah, I mean, so my book is an advocate of degrowth, you can say. But let's also remember that degrowth is just kind of a repackaged, some might even say kind of a technocratic version of something that eco-socialists and eco-anarchists have been saying for a century and a half, if not two. So, but in the end, I'm an advocate of degrowth. I think that, you know, when I say that from wherever anyone is to act and to try to create that space, I see degrowth as trying to create that space in policy networks and things like this. There's obviously some issues for how it actually relates and speaks about and acknowledges different kind of combative and kind of eco-autonomous and anarchist movements on the ground, which I think are kind of actually living degrowth. But in the end, degrowth is, I think, fundamentally and a really important and a great thing going on. And I'm a fan of Jason Hickel's work. Green New Deal. I mean, this is... I'm not at all a fan of the Green New Deal. You know, I could see there being maybe some useful reforms in there. I mean, there's two things. There's the European Green Deal, which is ultimately the Green Deal version that's being rolled out, which I think is catastrophic in many ways. And it's just extending kind of socio-ecological destruction via low carbon infrastructures and digital technologies. Not to mention when we talk about digital technologies, just the kind of levels of social control that are being enacted, not only through kind of smart technology measurement and monitoring, but also especially with the new electric vehicles. And I think there's been a recent report released actually how even in your car, you know, the new data that's being collected on your habits, driving, sexual activity, business, and how these things are being monitored and listened to. And then your data is being sold. you name it, you know, all these kind of green technologies are being wedded to capitalism, and they're advancing extractivism. They're advancing kind of and advancing social control. So, yeah, I want to be positive that there's some reforms. You know, obviously, we all want to believe in just transition. But at what point is sustainable development just transition? Green New Deals and even degrowth to a lesser degree, how much are these actually just ways to kind of rebrand or soften the existing kind of trajectory, which even, and this is the thing with, so even if you were to believe the premises of green technologies, which I don't, or low carbon infrastructures, even if you're destroying less in that technology, but you're producing more of them and continuously, then you're still going to have a greater accumulation of destruction. So if you have more technologies that are consumed or that are destroying things less, you're still having and creating more cumulatively. So yeah, there needs to be a real rethinking of how we're living, what we're doing, and what really matters in our lives. And this really means holding political authorities accountable, whether they're corporations, politicians, or local municipalities, to actually begin making these changes. You mentioned earlier, you know, talking about the Anthropocene. I reject that term. And, you know, there's many good reasons. And you mentioned you had Jason Moore on here before. The Anthropocene is, again, kind of this problem of even climate change as a framework to talk about things is this, again, large, all-encompassing planetary kind of phrase. It tries to equalize the responsibility for what's happening to the planet to everyone, which isn't true. It's a specific class. It's specific structures. It's specific infrastructures and institutions that are responsible for these things.
Why do you say that? We're all consumers. Everyone will say to you, well, you can't comment. You know, you go on holidays, you fly, you've got technology. So somehow we're all embedded in this. How do you single out a particular class as being, what's your argument around that?
Well, I mean, you can kind of, in your own terms, some are more embedded in this than others. Some are benefiting from this more than others. So certainly the tentacles of capitalism and modernity have definitely touched everywhere at this point. There's no question about it. But when I talk, and this goes back to what I said already, you know, when we talk about institutions, military, police, paramilitary institutions are not only in terms of resource consumption, but also environmental degradation amongst the most responsible. Same with all the kind of digital infrastructures and things like this that need to be kind of questioned. And again, you know, can you actually put the fate and destruction of the planet onto different indigenous people? Or indigenous black and brown people in different migration corridors with the legacies of slavery? No, you can't, even if people are in this. And this kind of alludes to, I mean, again, people have responded to this with the Capitalocene. People have responded to this with the Plantationocene. You know, eco-anarchists have really stressed and continue with the idea of this Necrocene, really looking at the destruction and extermination of different plants and animals. And so when we talk about the Anthropocene, this has been kind of criticized by some as being this kind of narcissistic kind of way of putting humans at the center of the universe still and once again. And ultimately, yeah, being completely unfair with actually assigning responsibility to these things. And really, and to be more specific about what you're asking, even when we go back to when we look at the development of industrial modernity, whether it's capitalists, whether it's authoritarian socialists or other socialists or communists, we could say anti-authoritarian communist articulations, you know, we've watched very specific class, institutions, and people force through and fight for their version of the world that they wanted to see. We can see this either through the formation of empire and monarchies or through the rise of kind of colonialism in terms of how local populations and people were subjugated to kind of create and to enforce and to socially engineer this trajectory of development, or kind of creating the quote wealth of nations, thinking of Adam Smith, you know, really in terms of even how we reproduce, how we consume. These are all completely socially engineered projects that have been kind of forced through so you can grow the wealth of nations, so states can grow, so they can gain power, they can fight with others, they can go spread through colonial ventures. So when we talk about the Anthropocene, there's an insane, in terms of who is responsible and how this was created, there are very clear actors, there are very clear people, there are very clear institutions that are enforcing and keeping this trajectory. But yes, as you say, everyone's kind of, I think, kind of the strength of capitalism, and you said you wanted to talk about capitalism, is it's not just repressive. It's not just the police and military and paramilitaries. I think the strength of capitalism is its enchantment. It's the ways that it's always used different kind of food, different kind of information communication technologies, television, computational technologies, the way that it's cultivated desire, the way that it's disciplined ambition into people to even kind of climb up the kind of different institutional structures in of kind of the state model or even in Western European kind of institutions, and the way that model through colonialism was spread through the world. And at no shortage of divide and conquer strategies and warfare against different people across the world. So when we talk about the Anthropocene, as so many people have said before me, it's completely inadequate in talking about it. And again, Moore's Capitalocene,
yeah.
We have the Plantationocene, Necrocene are all preferable. And there's so many, the Wastocene, there's a new scene every week to kind of looking at the different aspects that are neglected in that term.
Grounded in many ways in field work. I'm just wondering what you learn spending time in places directly impacted by the mining and the infrastructure projects, and how does that complicate or help us think about the kind of ways we think about generally development and sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, so the conclusion of the book really tries to synthesize, you know, I lived and worked in
your research is
wind energy development for many years, going back and forth, you know, with Andrea Brock, looked at the Hombok Forest coal mine, the Bayatambo conflict in Peru, fighting a copper mine that still isn't open yet, you know, thanks to the resistance of people there. Also, a series of conflicts, you know, energy infrastructure conflicts and power lines in southern France, and also, you know, Iberia and Catalonia and Spain. And also an open pit lithium mine struggle that's still ongoing right now in Portugal. And the conclusion, you know, actually talks and tries to synthesize some lessons there. But I think what I want to say here, not to kind of give it away, or maybe to even go deeper, is to say that, you know, people, as cliche and annoying as it is, you know, you have to act local and think global. You know, this really depends on the space that people are organizing and making for themselves and the interest and the care that they're taking in their own environment and actually syncing up and networking with other people in struggle in those areas. You know, I guess the international solidarity, you could say, or even interregional solidarity.
Do you see increased instances of that? Because it does seem often that many of these organizations, many of these groupings, they're plowing their own field. Then understandably, they have a lot on their plate. And as you say, it's a local thing, primarily in some cases, many cases, you know, and there are, you know, local stakeholders, local different kinds of power structures that they need to deal with. But actually, so many groups, so many even, you know, small NGOs or small systems change or small, you know, that just working in their own field.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, certainly that's taking place. And we can almost speak kind of stereotypically is that things might start, quote, not in my backyard struggle. But then as soon as they actually engage that struggle to defend their land, they start looking out. They start looking and seeing how there's many other people in similar circumstances. There's always different struggles, autonomous and eco-anarchists and different people fighting and actually building these networks and trying to create those networks of solidarity and work with these different communities, which has a whole set of different challenges. But I think there's a politicization process in terms of what's happening with people who are maybe just looking in their own backyards. But as my friend Boyana says, you know, there's no such thing as a not in my backyard struggle. If you're a land struggle, if you're farmers who are facing a mine or wind turbines or some energy infrastructure, you know, that food that they're farming or even that cattle or livestock, you know, that stuff is what goes into the supermarkets or people's mouths or in the local market. So when people are defending the land, they're also defending qualities of food that ripple out and are not restricted to people's backyards. But to really focus in on your question is that, yeah, in a sense, you have, I think, all these struggles. People are kind of keeping to themselves. Then, you know, they're greeted with some type of mega project or development project. They usually witness some form of corruption in the town hall in terms of some politicians breaking kind of protocol to kind of fill their pockets or to approve a project, often with pressure from kind of a state or federal government, like another higher tier. And then this forces people to organize and they create civil society groups. And it's a process of politicization. And then they meet people who've been fighting mega projects for 10, 20, 30 years and who are kind of, well, that are have been struggling against these. And there's kind of these exchanges, but still sometimes it's very hard when you're coming from hardcore Catholic backgrounds, conditioned with certain types of middle-class moralism in terms of actually having the skills and the ability to fight these things.
Are you witnessing more on the land fights and the kinds of issues that you've been exposed to, where you've seen people fighting? And I guess, does that inspire you? And I guess to broaden that out, what inspires you really about what you see today?
Yeah, so everything I said, I've witnessed it more than a handful of times, if not two or three handfuls of times. People are confronting a similar problem, and that's the expanse of extractive modernity, and it's threatening all sorts of kind of vital ecosystems. And there's a learning curve, there's a steep learning curve, and it's sad, especially with kind of repression and things like this, that in terms of there is some institutional memory that gets lost, or it makes this a bit slower. But it is continuing and it is building. And I think kind of the most important thing here is that people. So I guess the thing I want to talk to you about before getting into what's inspiring is that there's a lot of distractions that are preventing people from focusing on what really matters. And sometimes that's repression, which is the most predictable and kind of clear cut one from police, military. But then also sometimes there's the influence from different churches. Sometimes there's the way that NGOs are kind of tampering in these things, and all of a sudden, or even the media, and then all of a sudden, and sometimes internal group dynamics, if one is taking a very hard kind of collective approach. And sometimes the issues then become aren't about the issues anymore. It's about kind of the infighting. It's about these different things like this. And I think there's two things that are really important. I think everyone listening to this needs to look at themselves and be like, all right, am I going to take an active part in? One could say resistance, but I think it's more positive to say and more accurate. Am I going to take an active part in cultivating healthy relationships, healthy soil, water, and defending that with everything I got? And I think it's starting from there and building networks and talking to people is what's really important. And that really means, and that can take a lot of different ways. That can take on a lot of different levels, depending on your workplace and where you are. But I just can't stress enough that people really have to look at themselves and decide that, and they're going to use their common sense and what they know about life, and they're going to organize and create networks to actually resist, to defend what they love, and that's the different their relationships they create and the things that they care about, and I hope that that's clean water, food, and soil. But the thing here is, you know, I think things like drugs, especially methamphetamines or some type of amphetamines, you know, alcohol, different kind of technological. I think there's a lot of different kind of technologies in place that are designed to divide people and mess with them psychologically that I there needs to be greater attentiveness to.
That's a great vision.
It's not just a great vision. It's already happening. People are doing this. It's alive and well, but there's also struggles, and it's a continuing process. And it's my hope for me that everyone, because it sounds like there's no shortage of care. There's no shortage of people who want to be, quote, activists, or who want to stop climate change. And it's for those people that care or posture or feel that way to really look at who's resisting, look at who's fighting, and look at how it's going, and to begin organizing and beginning that process themselves. It's already happening. It's there. And there's big barriers and challenges there. But everyone who cares, there's so many ways things can be done and spaces that created. And I think the most important part is just to actually, whether you're hardened militants or kind of a new kind of climate youth person coming up or XR, I think the most important thing is to actually just be able to kind of create that space or that line of at least critical solidarity for people to kind of work forward and do those things.
Where would you recommend people go to find out more about some of the ways in which people are taking action? Because much, as you say, is packaged by the media and packaged by corporations and packaged and hidden away in, you know, terms like net zero and so forth that are, you know, you need to unpack and understand, but yet all this is going on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places you can look, you know. I can rattle off a bunch of websites and, Matt, you know, look at the eco-anarchists and what they're doing. Look at Act for Freedom Now. Look at Return Fire magazine. You know, these are obviously intense publications and things, but that's the stuff that's going on. You can go to your local kind of anarchist bookstore or quote radical bookstores and see what's going on there and check in, you know. But maybe even better is just, well, I think you raise a big issue, which is one of the endless and continuing problems, and that's of rent and landlords and speculation and gentrification and really the importance of defending that space and to stopping and to taking active resistance in housing and fighting rent and fighting gentrification, which, again, for some of the magazines and places I mentioned, there are people that are taking a militant stance against these things that might be worth looking into. That is, if you care about these things, that is if you're interested, you know? So to go to the radical bookstores, go to the different kind of eco-anarchist magazines and websites or autonomous, you know, look at these things. I mean, academia, I'm afraid, isn't so much help in actually looking at real struggle and what's going on. And it's been my experience that a lot of the academics in these things, I mean, obviously there's exceptions, but they're not really clear about what's going on in the conflict areas, especially between the different kind of militant kind of leftist groups or even narcos or even the different kind of different anarchist groups in the areas and what's going on in terms of these struggles. But yeah, I would encourage people to look at who struggled before, you know, let's look to the Zapatistas in terms of what they've been doing. That's not to say try to mimic and be them like a lot of people do, but look to the different people who struggled. There's tons of different indigenous collectives and people fighting. There's tons of different resources. There's tons of different autonomous and anarchist fighters who are fighting not only against gentrification, but also to protect the land, sea, and their dignity in so many words. And it's,
why is the anarchist perspective important?
Well, I mean, in short, you know, the anarchists are the ones that are fighting. They're the ones there. They're on the streets. They're on the front lines. They're there with indigenous people. They're there with farmers. And there's also different autonomous tendencies that might lean more towards some type of Marxian influence that are there as well. But so the reason why I say this is that they're the ones that are fighting. They're the ones that are actually looking at and are taking, you know, they're making a practice out of it. And they're reflecting on it. They're writing. They're engaging in praxis through the different magazines and stuff that's outside the university. And really, in terms of, you know, just for a basic kind of understanding of eco-anarchism, the idea is that once you start enacting violence against the land, the animals, the trees, the forests, the rivers, it's not long before humans start doing that to themselves. So it really is this idea of understanding when you put violence into this world, how it will circulate and manifest itself. And even if it starts, when you start doing it to different and small creatures, it will continue. And it's about stopping those levels of violence. It's about breaking those different kind of hierarchies. In terms, and also this domination of people and also animals and the planet. And this really is, you know, in terms of a view, trying to do everything it can to change and to begin working with their habitats, to begin working with their ecosystems and also the people around them. And I think that's the most important thing here is that people begin working with their environments. They begin working with each other and not against each other the best ways they can. And this means hopefully people are taking up anti-authoritarian approaches that aren't trying to control and dominate other people, that aren't trying to pretend that they know what's best for them and how they should develop and that how a quote, a socialist modernism is the way for them to be, even though there might be deeper concerns, especially towards the environment or animals that are being neglected in these things, ultimately a friendlier version of industrial modernity. But this really is about kind of living in place and with the people. And when I say people, not just humans, but the different animals, trees, forests, and ecosystems there, and developing kind of a system of respect and reciprocation, which again can sound ideal, but I think this is the direction we have to go to actually begin remedying the wounds that is capitalism, that is modernity, and really trying to create a healthier system of actually using these different technologies. But again, given where we are and that I'm even talking into a computer the way I am right now, there's a long way to go, but I believe there's no shortage of gusto, care, and concern from people across the world from many different positions with many different skills and experiences that really want to stop this kind of destructive relationship and process that's going on that we can call colonialism, that we can call capitalism, that we can call that, and that's obviously relies on racism for these things and all sorts of discriminations. So it's with that, I think people need to move. And I think the anarchist well, among the different anarchist and autonomous wells, are important ones to look at, even if people are constrained and engulfed by different institutions.
Thank you very much, Xander. That's a very powerful vision and a very powerful message. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for the important work you're doing. I wish you all the best.
Yeah, thank you so much, Virgil. I appreciate being on here again. And if people have any more questions, yeah, check out the book, The System is Killing Us, at Pluto Books. And yeah, and I just like to give an acknowledgement to Toby Schoen, who's been locked up under kind of trumped up anti-terrorism charges, even though they've won their case. And they're more or less being held in communication management right now in UK prisons. And yeah, I hope people take an interest and see what's going on to people who are just even being suspected of being kind of ecological fighters in this struggle. So again, thanks so much. People know where to get the book. And yeah, great being here. Thanks so much.
The Environmental Justice Foundation is an NGO working to protect environmental security as a basic human right. Using powerful films and photography alongside hard-hitting investigations, EJF exposes environmental destruction and ensuing threats to human rights, telling the stories of those at the front lines. EJF takes local fights to the very heart of governments and businesses across the world to secure lasting global change. By providing training for grassroots campaigners, EJF also helps to give a voice to the next generation of environmental defenders, strengthening global action to protect people, wildlife, and our shared planet. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.